Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Hello, everybody. This is Alice Alvey, not Dave Lickin. Dave is out at the Mortgage Bankers Association in New York at the Secondary Market Conference in big meetings, and so he has to die trying to cover for him. So we're going to do our best here to bring to you a lot of information that's coming up on the qualified residential mortgage exemption, risk retention, QM, qualified mortgages, and so forth. But we are going to still always focus on our great guests that we have on the program. We have Joe Farr and Andy Schell with us today. And so I'm going to get started with you, Joe. How are you doing?
Okay.
And let's hear what's going on in the markets.
Thank you very much. I'm fine, thank you. And you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Hey, the sun came out in Michigan today, I think.
Wonderful. Alice, you know, the news this morning is obviously the news about Osama bin Laden. And interesting, it's had very little effect on the markets. Initially, there was a bit of a rally in the stock market, but that's not a big one. That's kind of petered out, and stocks are back to normal. Mortgage prices or MBS prices are a little changed from Friday. Oil at one time was up a pretty large amount, but it's since pulled back, and so you know, all the news is covering the event, but the event's really not market moving. So, everything's kind of back to where we ended Friday.
Oh, my gas isn't going back down to $3 a gallon, or is what that?
Well,
was
no, it's not going down. You know, at one time oil was higher, and there's still obviously a concern out there and a question out there of what kind of retaliation might occur and what might the consequences of a retaliation be on the markets. I mean, could it disrupt the supply of oil? Could it be something that could disrupt the movement of people in the economy in the U.S.? No one's thinking that anything huge could happen, but there's certainly a concern out there that something might happen. So initially there might have been a concern about that, but especially as it was reflected in the price of oil, but that has come back down. We'll just have to wait.
So what can we look at? What was going on last week?
Well, last week was a good week for mortgage rates. The big event last week was the Fed meeting. It was the first time the Fed minutes or statement was followed by a press conference. The press conference didn't reveal much. The minutes didn't reveal much of a change. In fact, pretty much the Fed said that they were holding where they were. No real changes was positive for mortgage rates. The Fed did express a little concern for inflation, although not enough to need to move. They indicated they were not going to change the QE2 program, so they're going to buy their $600 billion and do so by the end of June, as originally expected. They did reduce their.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
Well, the market expected it, so it wasn't a bad thing. Long term, we'll have to wait and see if it's a good thing in general, but no surprises meant no huge movement in the market, and no surprises meant somewhat good for both stocks and MBS prices. Also last week, we did see the first measure of first quarter GDP, and it was lower than fourth quarter GDP, but pretty much as expected. It was at 1.8% for the quarter, and 1.7% was expected, so that too produced very little in the way of movement. Treasury auctions were a little bit weak last week, which helped mortgage rates somewhat. Surprisingly, the housing data came in better than expected, better than the prior month. New home sales were up to a whopping $300,000 annual rate, but that is up from a $250,000 annual rate last month. And pending home sales were up 5.1% from February. So, you know, not great numbers, obviously, and but good they're moving in that direction.
That's right. Up is always good.
Up is good. Yeah. And then let's look at this week. We have the jobs report coming out on Friday. The economists are expecting an increase in jobs of 185,000. Unemployment rate will probably remain where it was at 8.8%. And that's really the big event. I mean, this morning's ISM index was it could have been a big event, but it was right on expectations and kind of overwhelmed by the news this morning. But
yeah.
Next week, this week, people will continue to have their eyes and ears open to events following up, following up this the Osama bin Laden issue, and there's issues in on the European debt. There's concern that Greece is going to have to restructure its debt, and the markets will be watching that. Fed Chairman Bernanke is going to be speaking Thursday morning at 9:30 Eastern time, and everyone's going to want to listen to that. So. Not a whole lot other than the things you really cannot schedule for, and you're just going to have to pay attention to what's going on around the world.
Yeah, and we will definitely be looking toward that speech because, as you know, we always have to analyze every single word he has to say to see if there are any clues in there. But it's good
every
to know
pause.
That there was, not a lot of unexpected news so far. So, well, that sounds great, Joe. Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to our total discussion on risk retention because we're interested in your thoughts on how this is going to impact the industry and what are some of the things that we can say to respond to this proposed rule that's out there. So thanks so much. Informative as always. Next, we're going to get into some accounting issues. Oh, wait, no. Next is me with the legislative updates. So
there you go.
We're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteland delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lincoln on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lincoln.
Hello, everyone, and as I mentioned already, this is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave Lincoln, and now, as usual, is our time to talk through the legislative update. You know, it's hard to think about anything else besides risk retention and QRM and QM. Those are the two big proposed rules that we're watching and we're going to be dissecting later on in the program so that you understand how you need to get out there and comment on these. There are lots of opportunities in both of these proposed rules. The credit risk retention requirements that includes the definition of QRM and the qualified mortgage proposed rule, three separate topics, but two rules that you want to make sure that you feel confident the Fed and the agencies want to hear from us. There are lots of parts within these rules where they present, here's the definition of risk retention and where we're going with this. And here are the 7 or 8 questions that they then ask where they want feedback from the industry. So we're going to be dissecting this in a later segment, but just right now in the legislative part, wanting to give you the confidence that there are parts of this that everyone is qualified to respond to provide your feedback on impact to the market, impact to the consumer, and the pros and cons about these rules. So the credit risk retention requirement rule that is also discussing the definition of a qualified mortgage, those comments are due by June 10th. So you want to make sure you listen to this program and the next few programs so that you can get confident in how you want to respond. The qualified mortgage proposed rule was issued in April, and so it now is going to have its 60-day comment period, and therefore April, May, June, July, I'm sorry, 90-day comment period, and those comments are going to be due July 21st. So we have a couple of tracks we have to watch, and we're going to, again, going into much more detail on these in our next segment so that you can understand both of those. We also have the 8 bills that are out there that are going to be trying to address the future of Fannie and Freddie. So the House Republican Financial Services Committee passed these. It's H.R. 1223, which talks about GSE, Credit Risk Equitable Treatment Act. We have H.R. 1221, which is talking about the compensation that can go on over at Fannie and Freddie. And then another bill that's going to plan to get down the GSE's participation in the markets, get down the size of their portfolios, and lots of other pieces that they want to try and attack in terms of what the new structure of a Fannie or Freddie would be in the, going on in the future. We also have a few other bills that we're watching for you in terms of any kind of a proposal that would change the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to be a 5-person commission. This is House Bill 1121, and it also has a Senate companion bill, so that starts to tell us this might get some movement, that it, instead of a head of a CFPB, which would be an awful lot of power, if you look at what's going on in these proposed rules and how much is part of the Dodd-Frank Act, there's going to be a lot of power in that position, and a 5-person commission sounds to be a little more balanced, at least initially in its proposals. Also out for comment is a proposed rule that would prohibit incentive-based compensation for all employees, officers, and executives of a covered institution of $1 billion or more in assets. So your big lenders, there's a proposal out there to cap how much can be paid based on the loan closings and the origination in these loans. So we'll be watching that for you as well. A couple of our other comment periods actually closed out, and actually one closes today, and this is about high-priced mortgage loans. In the Truth in Lending Act, right now we have that a high-priced mortgage loan, if a loan is triggered and is found to be a high-priced mortgage loan, if the APR is more than 1.5% above the average prime offered rate, you trigger that it's a high-priced mortgage loan. What does that trigger do? That trigger means that customer is going to have an escrow account. Well, the way the rule's written right now is they would have to have an escrow account for 1 year. This proposed rule is saying let's make it 5, that the customer would have to have that escrow account for 5 years. That doesn't make a lot of sense, especially if you're a credit union, community bank, and you're saying, you know, I've got a really great customer, and there are some loans that's almost unavoidable in triggering that high-priced mortgage loan. How come we have to have it for such a long period of time? So we are watching those comment periods for you. That one actually expires today, May 2nd, if you have any comments about that particular one. There wasn't any big opposition to changing the statement of denial, termination, or change, so an ECOA amendment has a comment period that closed just a couple weeks ago, so look for that being a change in our denial notices going forward in the coming months. We'll let you know when that hits the rules books and when the implementation date would be. So that's my update for today. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals
providing classroom and web-based delivery
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lincoln on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's David Lincoln.
Hello, everyone. We're back again. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave, who is at the Secondary Conference. And up next, we have our session with the Profit Doctor, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions. Andy, are you there?
Hi, Alice. Yes, good morning. Well, you're doing such an amazing job filling in for Dave. You wouldn't even know he's not here.
Oh, well, I miss him. It's a lot of coordination here. Again, to Andy for coordinating that.
Yeah, lots of buttons to push. Well, you know, Dave is at the conference there in New York, and if you watched the news last night, right there in Times Square, there was the big events, I guess, spawned by the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. So I guess he was right there in the middle of it. I guess this is going to be, what are we going to call it, the OBL-D day? Osama bin Laden dead day? Who knows?
Oh, wow. I hadn't seen that. You know, I've been so busy reading regulations, I haven't had a chance to catch up on all that aspect of it yet, but certainly it was good news.
Well, I ran out of ink trying to write down all of the legislative points you were bringing. That's some of the stuff scary, too. It's like, oh, my gosh.
Right.
Well, the financial
update.
Well,
tell us a little bit about, I know you've had some interesting experience with customers these days, and you were going to share some of that with our listeners today.
Yes, well, the topic is on quality versus quantity. And so, like if I go to the grocery store, and in Texas there's a lot of grocery stores called H-E-B, and it's kind of like a Safeway. So you go into Safeway, and you go up to the ice cream counter, and there's a gallon of ice cream, and you look at the other choices, and there's a pint of Ben & Jerry's, and they're the same price. So Ben & Jerry's is, what, 8 times more expensive than a Safeway brand ice cream. You go, well, how can that be? Now, which is better? Well, you get the cheap brand and load it up with toppings, or you go with a high quality brand. And you know, do we want high quality or do we want quantity? Assuming we can't have both. Well, I tend to be more of a quality guy myself. I prefer to savor every bite. But you know, when you're out looking at mortgage companies, if you're out shopping for ice cream, and also if you're out maybe shopping for mortgage banks, we've got. People that we're working with who are looking at buying mortgage banks. It's like we're the mortgage bank grocery store. People come to us to find mortgage banks. And so we've got investors that are looking for big mortgage banks and bigger mortgage banks. We've got big and bigger mortgage banks, a $2 billion mortgage bank, a $6 million mortgage bank, and bunches of others as well. But so which is better? Is it better to get a $2 billion bank or a $6 billion bank? Well, you know, automatically people may think that, well, bigger's better. Well, okay, what if the big bank made $10 million a year and the bigger bank made $12 million a year? So now do we know which one's bigger, which one's better?
Right.
You know, well, no, we still don't have enough information. So, okay, let's dig a little deeper. So let's look at some key performance indicators. Let's look at earnings on volume. So if the big mortgage company is doing 50 basis points and the bigger mortgage company is doing 20 basis points, so now we got the really big mortgage company's profit margin is actually smaller than the $2 billion mortgage company. So which one's better? Well, we still don't know, but we may assume, well, we can make the big company bigger, and so we'll just take this $2 billion company making 50 basis points and we'll turn it into a $6 billion company. Well, maybe not. What about operational efficiencies? What about scalability? Are we able to make those kind of leaps? And some may think, well, let's just take that bigger company and let's improve the margin. Well, maybe, but how? What knob are you going to turn to improve the margin?
Right.
In this example, we're looking at doubling profitability. We're looking at taking earnings on volume from 20 basis points to 50 basis points. So probably on this big company, it just so happens that the bigger company has big volume but lower margin because they're passing margin through to the customer to get higher volume, which that's a strategy. It's a little bit of a concern because it increases repurchase liability, but that's another way to do it as well. But we're just starting to look at this challenge, and the reality is we still don't know enough about this company. So we've looked at some of the financials, and we hope we know what the financials are. We look at the volume, hope we know what the volumes are. Well, what about legacy issues? What about, you know, investor lawsuits and employee lawsuits and employee issues and pending repurchases or repurchases that haven't even been delivered yet? And what if the aggregators have piles of repurchases that they haven't passed on yet? You know, if you buy the stock of a company, then you're going to get all of that liability landing squarely on you. So the best way to avoid the legacy liability, which can be very significant, is to just purchase assets out of the company and not purchase the stock. But if you only purchase the assets and not the stock, then you don't get the EIN, which you need for the HUD transfer, and you also don't get any of the agency approvals.
Right.
Well, and, you know, and even sometimes when you do buy the stock, you still don't get the agency approvals. there's all these questions, so many, many questions. And, you know, Alice, one of the things that you get into often is efficiency, operational efficiencies. So if you're looking at buying a company, what about their operational efficiencies? Is it driven by their systems or their people or their training? Or what happens
right.
if the op team quits? Or what happens if the branch quits? Or, you know, it just goes
well,
on and on.
Well, you have no idea on the scalability. As you said, you know, some people, you really don't know what their crush point is. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And you know, if they're passing the margin on to the customer, that's great. Maybe they're even looking at the value of the cross-sell opportunities that may go with that if they're a depository. But all that has to be quantified. And I think operationally you have to see if they ever even have they ever tested their operations to see if they could handle more. I don't know. So far, Andy, I'm still missing a lot of information to help me decide a 20
yeah.
basis point guy or a 50 basis point guy.
Well, you know, and are their computers old? Do they need to be replaced? Is the data integrity
oh, yeah.
good? You know, is there regulatory reporting strong? Are the warehouse line lenders about to pull the line because there's debt covenant issues? Are the investors about to cut them off? Have we checked the scorecards? You know, all this has to be looked at. So even if you think you found a clean platform, how do you know? Well, it takes – this is kind of the point I wanted to get to. It takes weeks of due diligence to really evaluate, if not months of due diligence to really evaluate transactions. We've got one transaction that's been pending for almost a year through various stages of due diligence. And any investor looking to buy a mortgage company needed to accept at the very beginning – that is time-consuming and expensive to thoroughly perform due diligence, but it is one of the most essential, if not the most essential, element of investing in a mortgage company. You've got to understand what you're getting into. And, you know, we see people hiring CPA firms, you know, big Deloitte, big CPA firms to bring people in to do mortgage operational assessments. Well, you know, I'm a CPA, and I've been in mortgage for a long time. Your baseline CPA doesn't have that level of training. You need to get mortgage banking operational experts to come in and look at mortgage banking operations. Somebody like
that. And neither does the attorney. You wouldn't even have an attorney. You know, a lot of people do the CPA-attorney combination, and I've watched, well, I really get along with this partner here. I think I want to do business with them. And they're so focused on just getting a contract worded correctly as opposed to, like what you're talking about, really knowing what they're buying.
Yeah, exactly. It takes, you got to come in, evaluate it, talk to the staff, talk to the processing group, talk to the underwriters. It's amazing what I've talked to you about this before. It's amazing what you specifically will pull out of people as they're talking about their business. And you know, there may be hidden files in the drawers. There may be repurchase demands under the kitchen sink. You just don't know until you get in there and really start digging in. And
there's always a holy cow on day one.
That's right.
There's always a holy cow. Did you know that was going on? No, I didn't know anybody was doing that.
You know, so when you get into this, it's important to have a financial forecast based on where the company really is and where you think it can go, both in terms of volume and earnings and cash flow. And it has to be really solid, defendable assumptions. You've got to run KPIs on all the financials and the operations and the staff and the turns, and you've got to have something to compare those against. You have a way to measure the assessment and know what good enough really is. And so it gets complicated. To some degree, becomes one of my soapbox topics because we see people heading down these paths and it just goes kaboom. And if they don't do a really solid assessment, it almost always blows up. And it's like once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's really hard to get it back in. Really, the best advice is don't open up the tube unless you're sure. So,
Andy?
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, I'd like to add, you know, in buying a mortgage company, all the due diligence you can do, and I you have to do that, you're never going to uncover everything. So in buying a mortgage company, whether you're buying stock or even if you're just assuming, taking on assets and assuming operations, create a holdback. Make sure that you're not dispersing all your money until you've gone through the time period to see those issues and to provide a friendly way, if you will, to absorb those issues without having to go back to the sellers and ask for cash back. Hold it, and then give them the money after you've experienced a great time.
Yes, exactly. Holdbacks are great, and payouts over time are great. Those are great points, Joe. Yes, absolutely, I agree.
Well, thank you both for your feedback. It's a great. Anything else, Andy?
No, Alice. Thank you very much.
All right. I think we'll all have that toothpaste visual in our head now for the rest of the show. How do I get that back in there? Right. Well, because there's nothing, you know, once you get into a regrettable situation, now you're just spending so much time and effort trying to fix it. So the money spent up front on the due diligence absolutely pays for itself in a short period of time. So thank you so much, Andy. Still to come, we are going to get into the details of risk retention and the qualified residential mortgage exception. So we will be right back after this brief break.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success, Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging,
financial and accounting services,
or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave Licken today. And in this segment, we are going to have Joe Farr, Andy Schell, and myself working through the details of the risk retention and qualified residential mortgage information that's within the proposed rule we are now facing. This is another component of Dodd-Frank. It is the credit risk retention requirements. That's the name of the proposed rule that's out there, and we have until June 10th. It seems a little ominous that, you know, 232 pages, but there's a big segment of this that talks about, you know, what are the underwriting standards going to be for commercial lending and auto loans. Boy, not only are we getting picked on, but so are there's going to be qualified mortgages for auto financing. Excuse me there, as I had to take a sip of water. So, where we're going, what we want to start with is the credit risk retention portion of this, and starting with really just the definition of securitizers, and this applies to asset-backed securities, the ABS. So, who is a securitizer? That it within this rule, it really encompasses a person who organizes and initiates an asset-backed security transaction by selling or transferring assets, either directly or indirectly, including through an affiliate, to an issuer. It is essentially the definition of a sponsor. Therefore, what you'll find is as people talk about this, they're going to use the term sponsor, that the sponsor must retain 5% of the risk for in each one of these ABS that are sold. So let's just kind of talk about at first that who has to hold the risk. And when you read the rule, it does say that the sponsor would have the choice as to whether or not to get the originator involved in this and whether the originator would have to hold any of the risk. Joe, what are your thoughts on that as we look at the originator involvement?
I see it a little different. It says that the originator may elect to hold some of it.
Oh, right, that they get to pick.
Yeah, and so you know, there's going to be a negotiation between whoever's putting the securities together and the originator, and it's going to come out in the form of price. If the originator is going to retain some of the risk, then they're going to get paid less. If they're going to absolve themselves of any risk, meaning that the sponsor is going to retain all the risk, then they'll get paid less. And it'll be a matter of, one, can you afford to be paid less and still make money, and or do you see a better return by retaining and taking, assuming some of the risk without expecting to realize losses?
So do you see that, you know, there's the opportunity in here for all different formulas?
I really do, and I think they've left it intentionally open for the market to establish, you know, what's going to work out. I do think that they'll create some standards. I'd hate for us to get back to the days where every deal is structured, and you know, like the old participation agreements, But you know, there'll be an opportunity to negotiate either some or, you know, retention of some or all the risks at the originator side position. And you know, there'll be some standards established. It's just going to take a while to get there. It's kind of like the loan officer comp issues that were just put out there. They're general. They're providing general, you know, advice or instructions, and then expecting the market to figure out how to make it work.
Andy, how about you? What are your thoughts on this part of it?
Well, it was interesting because Alice sent this out yesterday evening, and so I was working on the slide presentation for our Campus MBA webinar, which is tomorrow on loan level accounting, and I got Alice's email with the 270 pages, and I was supposed to read it all last night while I was doing some other stuff. And, no, I'm just kidding. It wasn't all 270 pages. Alice condensed it for us. But still, as I was reading through the rules, you know, it felt very contradictory, and I read it again, and I thought, now, wait a second, what does this really say? And like the part we're talking about now, it says the originator risk retention would be voluntary through some sort of contractual agreement with the sponsor. And I'm thinking, well, okay, if it's voluntary, then why would I ever do it? Well, and to Joel's point, it depends. There's probably some pricing parameters it would be adapted to make it so that it did make sense. And I really, you know, Joe mentioned about the old days in savings loans when we used to retain 5% of the loans we originated, and it had this participation agreement, and that it struck me a little bit like that. But that is a terribly illiquid and inefficient market, and so we've got to figure out a way to accomplish the goal they're trying to accomplish, excuse me, while at the same time preserving liquidity. And I'm just not getting the sense that we're preserving liquidity. It feels kind of like a lead ball chained to 2 feet while I'm trying to run down the beach. So it's, which would be an interesting sight, I can tell you. But it strikes me as really complicated.
Well, I think one of the pieces too that's referenced is, you know, the one part I know we've seen summaries. One of the summaries we were looking at led you to believe that the originator had to hold at least 20% of the loans in the securitization. Well, the clarification of that appears to be that under the proposed rule, a sponsor could potentially allocate a portion of the risk retention requirement to a small banking organization only if such organization originated at least 20% of the securitized mortgages. So that was just some clarification on that in terms of the skin in the game seems to be negotiable at this point. Joe?
Well, and it makes sense given that you consider how many different originators sold the loans to the big aggregators, to Wells or Chase or B of A, whoever, that got put into a security. Does Wells really want to have, you know, 150 different risk-sharing arrangements on the loans in that security?
Yeah,
you know, if you're held to 20% or more of the loans in that security, that means they could have five, right? But it does make sense that there'd be no opportunity, at least as far as the risk sharing, like they refer to them as vertical and horizontal risks and L-shaped risks, which is a combination of the two. They're saying that those are the ones that require 20% participation in or contribution to the security in the form of originated loans. The others you might still be able to. For instance, there is a provision in the risk sharing arrangement where, and I don't know how this is going to work, but you can retain 5% of a sample of the loans produced. So if you produce 100 loans, you could sell 95 of them. You could keep five, and you'd have a 5% risk retention. But who's going to pick which five are kept? And you know, how is an aggregator going to know you're keeping five? There may be answers out there, but I bet that those answers are going to be developed based on how people reply to the request for comments.
Right. Well, and in that scenario, I would envision I'm essentially almost like my own issuer. I'm forming in my pool, then I have to flag which ones I'm keeping. And if I'm the one who gets to decide which loans I'm keeping my mom's loan, my friends, and the 50
mm-hmm.
LTVs.
Right.
And then you can have these other, you can have the 95ers.
Well, I think it makes it's important to point out here, because I take some comfort, and I'm sure everyone takes some comfort in the fact that Fannie and Freddie loans are exempt right now. And what we need to encourage is that people look at this and assume Fannie and Freddie are no longer around, because this rule is going to be in effect when after they are, potentially. And so what we're going to be stuck with is at that time is being up for comment right now. And so do look at the rule and consider no Fannie and Freddie, and then make your comments.
Andy, anything else on the risk retention in terms of the vertical, horizontal, or this idea of keeping a representative sample of the loans?
Well, I think Joe covered it well. I think it's really interesting to get into the QA aspects and the QRM aspects. And if that's coming up next, then I'll save my comment till then.
All right, great. Well, when you take a look at the rule, you know, there are, and I'm just glancing at it right now, just in this one section about risk retention, and I think this is the horizontal risk, no, this is the general section, there's 26 questions that the agencies are asking us for feedback about. So you really, if you're familiar with this side of the industry, you're involved in secondary market, and you get the trickle-down effect to each one of these, you know, take a look at this section and help with responses, because I get the impression when I read this that the answers were not carved in stone on how this functions within Dodd-Frank. It was just, you know, these high-level ideals, and the actual function of it has a lot of unanswered policy, procedural questions that's what this rule is trying to get at, that could essentially help really minimize the impact that just the one sentence of 5% risk retention can have. At least for me, when I thought about mid-sized lenders, I really thought, wow, is this going to put all those great mid-level lenders out of business because no one has that kind of capital? And when you start looking at the possibility that of the sponsor-originator relationship, and as you were referencing, Joe, multiple options within that for arrangements, you know, what does it ultimately mean? I think we've all agreed higher rates, but does it still mean that the good mid-sized mortgage bankers can be in business? You know, they're with the right response, I think there can still be a place for it.
Well, so Alan,
yeah, Alice,
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to.
Which one?
Andy, go ahead.
So given that this is proposed rule, and given that it sounds like they're asking for questions, and given that there seems to be such blatant contradiction within the rules, how do we go about doing that? To whom do we send our notes that says this is dumb? Or maybe we don't say that, but maybe we come up with something that's, you know, smart to say, but what do we do about that?
Well, all the agencies are part of this. So FDIC, the Federal Reserve. So if you are regulated by any one of those, you know, the SEC, Federal Housing Finance Agency, Department of Treasury, so they are collectively, and HUD, the agencies. The first page of the rule, which you can, you know, use your search engine and it'll come up, gives you how to respond if you want to respond to a particular agency. But you can send them emails, which I think is really sometimes an easier way to go through than trying to navigate through the rulemaking portal. So you can send an email to comments@FDIC.gov. You can do emails that go, I think last week I gave out regs, regs.comments@, and again, this is an email address, @federalreserve.gov. So regs, regs.comments@federalreserve.gov is an email address you can use to send them out. If you want another method, all the links, and if you want to handwrite a letter, or if you want to hand deliver a letter, it tells you can do that between 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. at 17th Street Building. So, Joe, you had something else you were going to add to.
I was just going to talk about the fact that, you know, higher risk loans have always had higher rates, and all that's happening now is the risk is not being passed on to the investor. Ultimately, a part of that risk is being retained in the origination channel, and those people are going to get paid more for taking that risk. Or the consumer is going to be asked to pay more for risk, period, whether it be Fannie, Freddie, or Ginnie loans now, they're going to start seeing higher guarantee fees, and so they're going to start paying more for the risk, and they're going to pay more for the risk in the future, and therefore those who retain the risk ought to be compensated for it, and that's all going to be a matter of who gets what part of that compensation. Not as much of it's going to be passed on to the investor.
Do you think anybody's pricing in for this now in preparation for this?
No. Well, you've seen it somewhat. You've seen FHA MIP go up some.
Sure.
We know that agency guarantee fees are about to go up. They're not going to go up all at once. They're going to stair-step higher, but that's coming.
Okay.
Well, this feels intrusive a little bit, and it feels complicated, and it feels confusing because it is. But, you know, this is part of the path to getting our jumbo markets thriving again. I mean, like it or not, we need the asset-backed market and residential mortgage-backed security for non-conforming product to be active and thriving. And maybe we don't do subprime right now, but let's do jumbos. And we need more. There are markets in the country that need more liquidity to help some of the price support that needs to come into the market. So this is really a good thing. I think it's different, and we don't like the change. We don't necessarily don't like the new rules we have to follow. But now is our opportunity to comment, and I think it's a good thing that they're asking. And, you know, too bad they didn't ask more about LO comp, but now we need to take advantage of this opportunity and say something about it.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point. You know, with LO comp, we really felt like that was the writing was on the wall. We really don't feel like we got listened to very well in how all that was going to pan out. And I think that's a completely different issue than this. This is LO comp was about one isolated, job description segment in the industry that they really felt they needed to change the incentive and motivation for a particular part of the mortgage process. This is a national issue. This affects so many areas of the industry, including real estate, title, securities, you name it, that they have to listen because they recognize there were a lot of holes left by the way Dodd-Frank worded things in that act. So, well, let's move to the other component of this, which is the qualified residential mortgages. So QRM.
Can we hit on QM?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Just real quick on QM, I thought it was interesting that it specifically states that the securitizer would not retain credit risk associated with securitization of an ABS for car loans or commercial loans or commercial real estate loans or even potentially residential mortgage asset class. But they also stated that they don't intend this to be a different set of guidelines than the QRM guidelines, but the QRM guidelines are very different. So,
yeah, they are.
Well, why is it that a commercial real estate loan securitization credit risk originator doesn't have to, or the securitizer doesn't have to retain it, but they do on a residential loan? That was just, I didn't get that.
Joe, do you have comments on that one?
My take on that is that residential mortgage loans are small and numerous and are supposed to be homogenous. Commercial loans in a security are fewer and not homogenous, and therefore investors do take the time to understand better what's inside there, rather than just seeing that they're 1,400 single-family residential mortgages.
Well, car loans were exempt too, and there's a lot of those.
I guess the car loan, you kind of have the sense that a car loan is has a value of some amount, whether or not
like a house.
Yeah.
I can go get it and take it away, and I don't have redemption periods involved.
Yeah.
We don't have to modify it. So, yeah. So I think, and that's another part of the regulation is there's just all those descriptions that take up a lot of pages, and our focus is for the mortgage side. And I think one of the things that really jumps out at me. So just to get everybody level on some of the components with this, the underwriting standards within QRM. Take an approach from a product standpoint as well as underwriting. So let's talk about product briefly here before we take our next break. On the product side, it would generally prohibit anything that has any kind of risk features. So negative amortization would be prohibited. Interest-only payments would be prohibited. No teaser rates, maximum 40-year term. And what I found
30.
Interesting is they – pardon me?
Maximum
yeah, nothing
30.
Over a 30. Yeah, I'm yeah. sorry, maximum 30. Yeah, no 40-year term. Yeah, 2-6 caps as a maximum on an adjustable rate mortgage. So you now have to go with – all right, what's interesting is then they go through and ask the questions. Are 2-6 caps the right number? I mean, should we look at 1-5 caps? Joe, thoughts on the product restrictions?
No, I'm glad they're asking. I think they're taking away a lot of opportunity for people. You know, all those products had good intentions and had a good customer. It was just not appropriate for other customers, like a 40-year mortgage. You know, that's an opportunity for people to reduce their payments some, and it works. It's helpful for some, and by restricting it, you're going to deprive some people of not just that one, but some people of an ability to buy a home that probably should be able to.
Andy, how about you?
Well, like the, no teaser rates. What if it's a home builder and they're willing to fund the, 2-1 buy down? Well, I guess obviously as long as you qualify at the fully indexed rate, then take advantage of the fact that there is a teaser rate. I understand the payment shock issue with the buy down, but I also understand first year in a house you've got to buy curtains and, you know, bug spray and all of a sudden. And as long as you're qualified at the higher rate, I don't see why it is that bad of a deal to have an investor-funded buy-down.
Yeah, I think that's a part that definitely deserves some comment, is about the financial advantages. As long as they're meeting the QRM, why does that have to be in conjunction with it? You know, that on top of that, now why can't I just offer them a deal to get in the house, and as long as I'm qualifying them, and actually the qualifying is that I'm qualifying them for 5 years out, whatever the potential rate is 5 years from now, they're going to still qualify at that rate. So, you know, if I, like in your example, you're offering them a temporary buy-down, that's just a cost benefit. Great. You know, I still have to qualify at the higher rate. So what
yeah.
harm is there in that? I agree. Yeah. So let's go ahead and take a quick break here, and we'll be coming back talking more about the qualified residential mortgages. And I have a quick FHA update for you at the end of this about the FHA approval deadlines looming in the next couple of months. We'll be right back after this short break.
PMI Mortgage Insurance Company is the clear choice for your higher LTV conventional borrowers. Unlike FHA, PMI offers a choice of flexible premium plans to fit the individual needs of each borrower, from a one-time upfront cost with no renewal premium to a monthly plan with no upfront charges. PMI's premium plans recognize larger down payment and good credit history, saving your clients what can at times be thousands of dollars. PMI also provides lenders with fast electronic submission tools to increase efficiencies. Mortgage insurance is more relevant than ever, so it's important to utilize a mortgage insurer who's committed to the business for the long term. It is vital that you work with a company whose core competency is credit risk management, and bring that wealth of knowledge to your firm. At PMI, mortgage insurance is their only business, so they have to get it right. PMI's mission is to create sustainable homeownership opportunities. To learn more about how PMI solutions can assist your business, please contact your PMI representative today or call 800-966-4PMI, 800-966-4PMI. In today's climate, quality counts more than ever, and Wetzel Trot can help your company maintain the quality that you require to survive in an ever-changing market. With over 450 customers across the country, Wetzel Trot has specialized in quality control reviews for residential lenders since 1985. Wetzel Trot can assist your organization in maintaining a high standard of quality within your residential mortgage operation. They offer a wide variety of services, including loan quality control, servicing quality control, quality control plans, fraud review services, and even web-based quality control software. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. Choosing Wetzel Trot represents a wise choice of many alternatives. Contact Wetzel Trot today for details at 248-592-2252. Wetzel Trot, the single source solution for your quality control needs. And now, Brian.
broadcasting live from Austin, Texas. We're back with the Lickin' on Lending Show.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice Alvey, filling in for Dave, and with me are Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions and Joe Farr of MBS Quote Line, and we are having our chat about risk retention and the qualified residential mortgage exception, and we are moving to the underwriting standards portion of this. I want to give you all kind of a quick summary of what the proposed rule is pushing out in front of us. First of all, there is a statement within the proposed rule that says we will be using the HUD guide, the 4155 used in HUD FHA underwriting, as kind of the framework for how qualifying works. This QRM, if you say we're going to start putting in rules, you have to say, well, what about compensating factors and underwriting? It really gets into calculations and documentation. It goes that deep into how we underwrite a loan. It's not just ADL TV. So the top level credit overlays, so to speak, coming out of QRM are that the maximum front end and back end borrower ratios would be 28 over 36. Who has that? That's, I'm sorry, we have a lot of tough loans these days. I don't think we see a lot of 28, 36. Then we have to have a maximum LTV on a purchase of 80%. And then for refis, it would be a maximum CLTV of 75. And that's a rate and term refi. And then for a maximum cash out refi, it would be a 70 LTV. So within just these components here, LTV and ratios, we have a lot that we have to try and figure out what makes sense. Oh, and another caveat I want to share with you on that 80 LTV is it would prohibit having any kind of a piggyback second. You couldn't do a first and a second on a purchase, piggyback first to purchase a home. And I'm sorry, I said that wrong. A piggyback with a first to purchase a home and still have it be a QRM. So, you know, Andy, I'm going to start with you on thoughts about LTV and ratios just to begin with in this discussion.
Well, I mean, it's back to the future. I mean, this is underwriting guidelines from 1978, and the thing that I thought was most striking about this is that the LTV ratio must be, it says under mortgage insurance, the LTV ratio must be calculated without considering mortgage insurance. That's in terms of qualifying as a QRM. I mean, that's completely disregarding the impact that the PMI coverage is going to have on the qualification of the loan. It's so incredible to me that they even started here. It's such a lack of understanding to begin with to say this is where we're going to start. 80% max MI doesn't count. It's like we really got to talk about this
out
point.
There.
What's
well,
that?
Well, I found some news reporters saying how PMI was not a compensating factor on the loan. They can't believe that people think, you know, PMI caused this problem or contributed to the cause. That is just so uninformed, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe,
we got a comment.
How about you?
We got to say stuff.
Yeah. Joe, how about you? Your comment?
Unfortunately, you know, if you are QRM, you don't have to have risk retention. If you're not, you do. And there's going to be a steep price to pay if you're not a QRM. And you think about being QRM and who can and who cannot meet those underwriting guidelines, it's going to have a disparate impact on a lot of your protected classes, a lot of first-time home buyers. And so, if you're writing about making changes to this thing, I certainly advise that you consider that because it's going to have a huge impact on those who can buy a home and even those who can move up from a first home to a second home.
And I think one of the things, too, that's important for everyone to understand is they're getting into these credit overlays that at first you think, well, the HUD guide isn't so bad. At least in some components it's a little more lenient than Fannie Freddie underwriting guidelines. But they're putting in overlays that are going to make it more strict. And another example would be that the borrower could not have had a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, a short sale, a deed in lieu, repossession, any federal or state judgment or collection within the last 3 years. So bankruptcy under FHA has always been a 2-year rule. So it really, like you're saying, Joe, it makes it a smaller pool, so what's going to happen to those who don't fit into this QRM? I think everybody, especially those of you on the origination and the sales side, need to get out there and comment, understand some of the things that they're proposing, really look at your files on, wow, if I had to have these credit overlays, what percentage of my customers would not fall in a QRM today in light of today's economic conditions? They're interested in hearing from you about your numbers and your pipelines. Manufactured homes would be okay, surprisingly. So, sorry, go ahead, Andy.
Well, and on that point, Alice, I don't remember you specifically stating this yet, but then looking at what you sent me that I read, it also says that to be a QRM, you cannot have had a 60-day delinquency in the last 24 months.
Yeah, and 0 times 30 in the last 12. So now you're saying no credit scores. The rule specifically says we're not going to set a minimum or a minimum credit score because that's a proprietary private company model. Companies can have their own models. DU may not be the same and so forth. So they've come up with credit underwriting guidelines. And, again, they're saying, tell us if this is reasonable. You can have a great credit score and have a 1 times 30 in the last 12 months, and you're going to tell me I've got a customer with a ton of money in the bank and I've gotten approved eligible, and if Fannie and Freddie in the future aren't part of this auto exemption, how do I meet QRM? So like Joe said, think of this outside of Fannie and Freddie. So let's wrap up with some final thoughts here. We've got just 5 more minutes left on the program. Joe?
Yeah, it's not just the mortgage industry. It's the home builders, it's the realtors, it's the appraisal industry, the title industry, the MI industry. I mean, everybody needs to weigh in on this, and you got to feel like there's a chance to make things better when you have both community groups and the mortgage industry working together.
Yeah, Andy, how about you?
Oh yeah, the fact that they're proposing this is like Joe said, if you are QRM, you don't have risk retention. If you're not, you do. So we want to be in the group that doesn't have risk retention. So to be in that group means we need to make it so that PMI matters. PMI counts. If you've got mortgage insurance and an 85 or 90 or maybe even a 95, but certainly a 90, if you've got 90 with mortgage insurance, that should be a QRM. I don't see how in the world that's not. So this is the point, the QRM definition. There's a lot of things to write about. There's a lot of things in this that are kind of interesting. This is the one that's driving it home because it's going to limit the people that can buy a home. It's going to increase the cost on people to purchase a home if they have any kind of a credit issue or a lower down payment. We've got to talk about this point.
Yeah. Well, next week, folks, we will be talking more. I'm going to have to give you an update on our FHA, just that May 20th is the deadline for the $1 million net worth for all existing FHA lenders. If you are if you meet the Small Business Administration definition and you have less than $7 million in annual receipts, if you're a non-depository and less than $175 million in assets for depository institutions, then you can fall and have a minimum net worth of $500,000. That deadline is May 20th for all existing FHA lenders, and then you'll have till May 13th to think about what you want to do to meet the $2.5 million net worth. And I'm sorry, May 20th of 2013 is when that $2.5 million net worth comes into play. Also on the FHA front, July 1st really is only a big deal deadline in terms of FHA for those of you who need principal agent relationships while you're going through your case studies. So if you are not DE yet, you're in your case study phase, and you have another entity who's approved as an agent for you, you're the ones who are going to have to watch that July 1st deadline. The rest of you, don't worry about it. It's not going to impact you. Next week, we are going to be talking about NMLS call reports due May 15th, giving you some more information on that, and really spending some more time on the QM and this bill that's so important to our industry. I really want to thank Andy and Joe. Thank you so much for all of your feedback and knowledge. It is so valuable. And Dave will be with us next week to be able to help us with watching that call report due date May 15th. Get that drilled into your head and start working on your data. So thank you, everyone. It was a pleasure hosting today, and we'll be with all of you next week.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week and thank you for listening.